Welcome to Hollywood Ungagged, the Georgios Giamakis of political podcasts. Well, it's been a big wait. It's been a while since our last podcast. We did intend to take a short break. It became a much longer break. We were visited by quite a few of the four horsemen of death, pestilence, and war. Unfortunately, the one that I could do with, famine, never showed up as my waistline continues to grow week by week. It was just Brian and I this week in the podcast. Deborah is going to be back for other episodes of season three, but she couldn't quite make it this week. But I thought about putting it off, but we felt as if we're getting to the stage where we're going to continue to be putting it off. So we just had to get back to making content and reminding you that we're still about and still alive and kicking. Obviously, a lot's happened in the last couple of months since our last podcast. The Russian invasion of Ukraine. We don't really talk about that, just to remind you that, we deal with sort of domestic UK issues. Just in case anybody's wondering why we don't bring it up, because it is obviously a major thing going on in the background at the moment. And our thoughts are with all the poor people caught in the crossfire there. So this week, Brian and I, we spoke about the potential Margaret Thatcher Day. We had a bit of disagreement about who thought that was a good idea. We spoke about the government's back and forth plans to do with banning conversion therapy. We're both quite happy to see ScotRail back under public ownership for first time in 25 years. We looked forward to the forthcoming local elections, and then we discussed the intricacies of Mr. and Mrs. Rishi Sunak's tax details. It's obviously been a wee while, which is why I managed to completely forget to plug the other podcast in Ungagged at the end. So I'll stick it in now. If you've got anything you'd like to see us talk about in Hollywood Ungagged, you can tweet us at underscore ungagged, hashtag Hollywood Ungagged, or you can send us an email at ungaggedleft@gmail.com, putting Hollywood Ungagged in the subject line. And I'd also ask you to give us 5 stars on whatever podcast platform you use. If you like this podcast, you might like some of the other podcasts that Ungagged produce, such as the North American-based one. It's a monthly podcast. It's called World Beat with George Collins. You'll be interviewing scholars, activists, and writers about the state of the world. And you can also hear the Sensibility podcast with Kat and Erin, which is also monthly. So I hope that wasn't too much of a rambling intro, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the podcast. Let's get ungagged. Hello and welcome to season 3, episode 1 of Hollywood Ungagged. It has been a long time in the making, and we took a short break, which turned into a slightly longer break and then a very long break. But happy to say we're now back. Joining me today is Brian Finlay.
Hello.
Don't get too worried, Deborah isn't here this week, but she is coming back. We've just had a lot of things crop up in the last couple of months between illness and bereavement and all kinds of stuff. So we're delighted to get back to recording, and hopefully we'll be getting the episodes out in a more kind of consistent weekly basis. How you been, Brian?
Very well. It does seem like forever, and I think it's actually been probably about 3 months since we've managed to pull some content together. So much has happened, obviously, during that time. Which is, I'm really excited to dive into it. But generally, I'm good living a quiet life, working, reading, following politics, getting angry, getting frustrated, the usual.
I should probably introduce myself, actually. I'm
You should,
just so arrogant, I just assume everybody knows who I am. So anybody that's not aware, I'm the host of the podcast, David McClement, and I'm transmitting from the Blantyre Free State. And yeah, I'm just back a short holiday. I was away down to Blackpool with my family, visiting my
Nice.
brother-in-law. So we went to Blackpool Zoo, which I think the last time I was in Blackpool Zoo, I was about seven.
It's in
So it was
Stanley
cheap,
Park.
just next to Stanley Park, yeah. But it was good. They don't have that many animals. I was in Chester Zoo a couple of years ago, and I think that's ruined me for all zoos because it appears in like the top 10 of like zoos in the world. So if you ever want to go to a zoo in the UK and you don't know what one to go to, I would recommend Chester. But Blackpool's all right if you're in a pinch.
In
If
a
you need,
pinch.
in a pinch, if you're jonesing for a visit to a zoo, and what the hell am I talking about? Jonesing for a visit to a zoo. Anyway.
But it's good that you're in Blackpool. I hope you had a good time. I love Blackpool. I'm going to Blackpool in September with my pal, because we've always wanted to go together, go to Funny Girls. We have a night out. I love Blackpool. I used to go at least twice a year when I was a wee. When I was wee, and I love it.
You broke your ankle in Blackpool, didn't you?
I did break my ankle in Blackpool, yes, on Hogmanay A 2017 into 2018. I was the first big operation on the 2nd of January 2018 in the Southern General in Glasgow.
Oh, something to put in the tombstone.
It's really something to put in the tombstone, and I still have the titanium plate and screws and everything holding my ankle together to prove it.
I actually can't believe that was over 5 years ago.
It's insane. Weird,
Yeah.
eh? Mental.
Well,
It's, yeah, 2018 was when I had my, and then I couldn't walk for like 4 months.
yep, I remember you being laid up.
Laid up.
Let's get on then. We've, like you said, there's plenty to talk about. So I'm sifting through all the different things that have happened and trying to figure out what was still relevant that was a big deal a month ago that maybe people don't really care about talking about now. But something I couldn't forget about was the Tory MP for South East Cornwall that called for the UK to follow the example of the Falkland Islands and adopt the 10th of January as Margaret Thatcher Day. And it has then also been backed by Government Minister Kemi Badenoch. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but she pointed out that the final decision would be Boris Johnson's. So, Brian, looking forward to Margaret Thatcher Day.
No, next question. No, I think when it comes to people talking about Margaret Thatcher Day, and remember Jo Swinson wrote that article. I can't remember exactly where it was that she wrote it, but there was that. It was about the statue, wasn't it? About how
Yeah, she wanted a statue.
we had to have the Margaret Thatcher statue, which is just weird. But when it comes to Thatcher Day, I think that Thatcher left such a horrendous legacy. Particularly in Scotland, particularly for queer people, particularly for the working class, particularly for unions, particularly for people who work in the public sector, left enough of a legacy that we don't need to remember this Prime Minister. So, no, we should not have a Thatcher Day. And
First woman prime minister, Brian. Come on, first woman prime minister.
yeah, and she done great for feminism, didn't she? Really good for queer women, women's rights, equality. All these different things. Great. Okay, first female prime minister. That argument gets me every time because she's just like, yeah, because she was so great for women and empowering people and equality, which she absolutely was not. So no, we shouldn't have Thatcher Day. And these people who kind of focus on these types of things, I just think is a distraction. I think it's a bit weird. We all know who Thatcher is. We'll unfortunately never forget her, particularly queer people who went to school between 1998 and 2001 in Scotland.
Yeah, it is a bit of a kind of thing, sort of. It's a kind of right wing sort of thing. You know, like in America, the Republicans are always screaming because they want Ronald Reagan added to Mount Rushmore and things like that. And like in the UK, I don't remember. I don't know. I've never heard of like somebody in the left demanding we have a day dedicated to, and no wonder because I've now forgot his name, the post-war Prime Minister, Attlee. I mean, I've never heard of somebody demanding that we have a Clement Attlee Day, which, you know, considering the achievements of his government, you know, I think it'd make sense. But, you know, Margaret Thatcher, you know, the right are falling over themselves to their fire at every junction.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just going to correct myself there, because in my rage at the end of that comment, I was saying I meant to say 1988, not 1998. But it's true what you're saying. Yeah, people on the left generally don't really... What I think is one thing that I've noticed, right, that particularly people on the left, and I'm saying that in inverted commas, tends not to put names and personalities attached to particular concepts or policies or achievements and things like that. I think it tends to be that this is a great thing for humanity, it's a great thing for the working class, it's great for minorities, and that's enough. But I think it's very much tends to be more on the right, that it's almost like, oh, this person, that, you know, Churchill done this and Thatcher done that, and, you know, the Iron Lady, and, you know, etc., etc. So yeah, I just think I just find the whole thing a bit weird.
Yeah, and I just want to point out, because I'm sure we might have loads of comments, but I'm more talking about the kind of UK, even the American sort of tradition of left right, you know. And mm-hmm. you know, I realize if you go to Eastern Europe and that, there's plenty of like Lenin and Stalin, there was a certain cult of personality involved there, so I'm trying to preempt any criticism there, but I'm just going to surprise you, Brian. I'm all in favour of Margaret Thatcher Day.
Wow, that's a turn up.
I think it could be a lovely, you know, we've already got a nice winter festival in terms of, in Scotland particularly, when we start at St. Andrew's Day, goes through to Christmas, or the New Year, then it goes right through to Burns Night. I think 10th of January, get the family together, get the bonfire going, and throw in a big effigy of Margaret Thatcher on there. I think that's fun for all the family.
Fun for all the family on the 10th of January.
Exactly. Roast some marshmallows on her flaming corpse. I think I could get my kids excited about that.
I think you could. Definitely get your kids excited about that. I just think days are weird. And is there a particular reason why we chose the 10th of January? I think I know where this is going.
I'm guessing there's maybe a Falklands connection, but I don't know that for sure.
War, yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be something about death, destruction, war, you know, something, you know, yada, 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 Britain, liberation, blah, blah, blah. Which is just weird.
We could switch it to the summer to have a whole barbecue theme. Maybe we get on board with that, since she is probably barbecuing in hell right at this very moment. So
it's possible, if you believe in religion, particular religion.
As an atheist, I do like to believe in hell when I think about Thatcher.
Fair.
Maybe that's hypocritical of me, but there we go.
Hypocritical. Thatcher Day, not so much. Remembering Thatcher, not so much. But then again, if you wanted to have Thatcher Day to raise awareness about some of the horrendous things that Thatcher's government done, then if you want to use it as a positive opportunity to educate people of how we should never have a prime minister with that ideology again, oh wait, we've already got one.
See, you know, I'm the more I think about this, the more I'm loving it. I think this could seriously backfire. Could you imagine how raging the Tories would be if, like, Scotland and the north of England and London was just, like, having these massive parties, you know, remembering all the horrific stuff that Thatcher did while burning an effigy? That would be fantastic. I think they would be campaigning to abolish it within a year, I think.
That would be funny. I know that is, you know, maybe I'm being converted around to the idea of Thatcher Day, I don't know. But yeah, I think, like, if this was to be forced on us, because it would be forced on us by Boris Johnson, who might go for it because he needs a couple of more distractions from him and his horrendous government. But yeah, if we were to have this forced on us, then it could be a real opportunity to speak about some of the horrendous policies, starting with Section 28, you know, the issues and the complete decimation of trade union collectivism, you know, the Trade Union Acts all throughout the 1980s, then yeah, it could be a really good opportunity for us to revisit some of those horrendous things that Thatcher done, and, you know, learning how we should never allow that to happen again.
And on that note, I think we'll say goodbye to that topic.
Bye, Thatcher.
So, the UK government provoked outrage last week when it leaked plans that it was proposing to ditch its ban on LGBT conversion therapy. The government announced a ban in last year's Queen's speech after it was first promised in 2018. Campaigners said that the move betrayed the LGBT community and MPs, including Tory MPs, branded it fundamentally wrong and nuts. Sources told ITV News that Mr Johnson was U-turning on his U-turn, and sources said he was changing his mind and would include a ban after all in the May 2022 Queen's speech. But ITV also reported that that proposed law would only cover gay conversion therapy and not trans in order to avoid unintended consequences. Brian, your thoughts?
I think we can all know where my thoughts are going with this one. But what unintended consequences would you have when you've got a really small minority of really vulnerable people who have basically been living through one of the worst moral panics that queer people have faced since the 1980s, ironically under Thatcher? What unintended consequences would they have going through, you know, conversion therapy, which is not therapeutic in any way, and basically conversion is assuming that basically there's something wrong with them and they need to be, you know, put back to whatever society says is deemed acceptable. I just don't understand what the unintended consequences could be of that. And, you know, and as a queer man, I'm very much of the view that if you're going to ban conversion therapy, it needs to be for all queer people, and that includes trans people. There was a huge demonstration over the weekend in London, where there was believed to be around 3,000 to 4,000 people who marched in support of including trans people in any conversion therapy ban. And within a couple of days, there was a petition for the House of Commons to include trans people in any ban, and it succeeded already, the 100,000 signatures needed, so it will then be forced to be discussed in Parliament. So there's obviously widespread support for this, and I find it really quite despicable that the Tories are yet again, after 40 years since Section 28 and all that type of rhetoric under the AIDS crisis and everything like that, is trying to split and divide the LGBTQ plus community, and it's unacceptable. And good for all the organisations who basically pulled away their support. There's over 100 organisations. Stonewall led this against the kind of global LGBTQ conference that was going to be held, which was hosted by the UK government. Because of this announcement about the ban, they've basically pulled the support. The conference has been cancelled, which has completely, you know, embarrassed the UK government on the international global stage, and good on them, because it's the only thing that is actually going to bring about positive change for this really vulnerable minority is to embarrass them, and good on them. So there you go. That's my views on that one.
Yeah, I mean, I find myself asking the same question a lot about the current UK government as to whether they are like idiots or whether they are like evil sort of cunning strategists, because either this has just been a complete disaster and incompetence for the word go, where they decide we'll just get rid of that and didn't expect any backlash, then panicked when they got a backlash, then kind of half U-turned and tried to think, well, okay, we'll do it for the LGB but not the T. So I don't know, you can read it as just complete incompetence and complete clownishness, but you can also read it as being very sinister in terms of, were they deliberately trying to drive a wedge within the sort of LGBT community, which is something that the far right in America has been very public about using as a strategy. And that's where the whole moral panic about trans people came from. It's about them saying, right, they recognised they'd lost the fight about gay rights, but they saw trans rights as being a weakness that they could use to kind of, you know, be a wedge issue, which they could then use to turn against, you know, the wider LGBT community later. So I find myself, I can never really tell with this government if they're actually doing things out of incompetence or malevolence.
Or a bit of both.
Yeah.
I think it's definitely is a little bit of both. But the problem is in the current Conservative government, which we know has lurched way to the right, you know, over the last 5 years or whatever, and it's continuing to do so, that I think there's so many different strands to conservatism in this current conservative makeup that's in Parliament, that it's almost these different sides grappling with each other to try and achieve whatever it is that they want to achieve. But it's just, it's so, so concerning and exhausting. As a queer person, it must be extremely exhausting and frustrating for trans people to see their rights and their very existence and their identities being, you know, discussed in such a horrendous way. And almost the government, at the top of government, saying that, you know, we definitely want to protect LGB people from conversion therapy because it's horrendous and we're actually going to put this ban in place, but we're not going to include trans people. That is horrendous. It's so, so bad. And I don't think that a lot of people understand. Just, it's basically, this is the most obvious example of exclusion. You know, a policy, a ban on conversion therapy, but they're going to exclude this very small minority that we have in this country because there might be unintended consequences. Unintended consequences is used to prevent progressive changes for centuries. So I don't buy it, but I think
the argument I've heard them put out is about doctors could get prosecuted for, you know, asking somebody if they really feel they are trans. Well, surely, first of all, I'm sure you could create legislation that would protect doctors in that situation.
Yes.
But also, if that's an issue in relation to trans people, would it not equally be an issue in relation to gay people? Like, if you believe those unintended consequences are something to worry about, why is it only about trans people that you should worry about?
Because that's the current moral panic. Yeah. You know, if the government, because the government, bear in mind too that the conversion therapy has been one of the key asks for queer organisations for a long, long time. So to think that we are in 2022 and we're still, you know, asking for this to be banned. But now, what they believe is for LGB people, if you wanted to categorize it like that, that it's almost like, well, it'd be socially unacceptable or not good for us to resist that any longer. But actually, what we'll do is we'll push the boundaries and see if, you know, for trans people. So these people are being dragged, kicking and screaming, and every single person that showed up in London to march and to make sure that there was our trans siblings were included, I think is great. There was a lot of support around the country on social media and all these types of things, and it's so, so important for allies who are exhausted. Trans people must be more exhausted, just to really just keep going and fighting, you know, for real queer liberation. That's what we're fighting for.
And it was great to see that kind of solidarity and unity is still there, because there's these very, very fringe organisations like the LGB Alliance that try to portray themselves as being a voice of a large section of the LGBT community, and they're not.
No, they're
ones
not.
That, you know, when it came to the crunch, the entire LGBT community were united and supported trans people being included in this ban.
Mm-hmm.
And then hopefully it's seen it off, because I think the hopes would have been that enough people in the LGBT community would have been like, okay, well, this is a win. We'll take the win and we'll deal with the trans conversion stuff further down the road.
Mm-hmm.
But it was great to see that they didn't fall for that trick, because that's what it would have been. It would have been a trap, because further down the road would never have happened.
Exactly. And the thing is, we shouldn't have had to have come further down the road. This is the main point. Like, when we started to get, gay rights, you know, even like, you know, bisexual people and for lesbians and for all the different queer people, trans should have been at the centre of that as well. Like, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. And this long road has been created because of political parties that have been in power. We should be well ahead of where we are now. And it's just exhausting to see this constant resistance. And it's true exactly what you're saying, that they're grappling with the trans identity and gender non-conforming people, and trying to make them out to be some kind of danger. But it's the same recycled nonsense that we've seen in the 1980s about gay men and lesbians and all this type of thing. Don't fall for it. Stand in solidarity with your trans siblings, and, you know, just don't just don't buy into it because it's a load of crap.
I think there's nothing more to be said about that. Thanks, Brian. We'll move on. And before we go to the next topic, there'll be a short word from our sponsor.
Our sponsor this week is Sense of Nature Pet Service, based in central Scotland. Sense of Nature gives you a hands-on, personalised experience with a variety of exciting creatures, from snakes and skunks to tarantulas and turtles. Sense of Nature has something for everyone. They offer sensory sessions, one-to-one and group sessions, educational encounters for children of all ages, and they are available for private events upon inquiry. Animal welfare is at the forefront of everything they do, and if appropriate, a risk assessment can be carried out at no additional cost prior to your booking. To get 5% off your next booking with Sense of Nature, quote Holyrood Ungagged 5 at time of booking. To contact Sense of Nature, you can do so by email on sense.of.natureinquiries@outlook.com. You can also find them on most social media platforms by searching for Sense of Nature.
Okay, the next topic we're talking about is ScotRail is now under public ownership. ScotRail is back in public ownership for the first time in 25 years. The train operator will now be run by a company owned by the Scottish Government. The previous operator, Abellio, had its franchise ended early amid criticism of the quality of the service. Passengers should not see any significant changes in services right away, but the Scottish Government said it was a new beginning for the railways. All ScotRail staff will transfer to the new Scottish Government-owned entity, and the move has been welcomed by trade unions. Thoughts, Brian?
Well, I'm really happy to see ScotRail put under public ownership. I think it's something that I've supported for a long time. I support much, much broader than that. I think public transport should not be run by private entities because it becomes fragmented, it becomes really costly. And we can see that in places like Glasgow, for example, where, you know, getting around by bus and all the different methods of transport is costly. They're not linked together and they're owned by private organisations, a lot of them. By all of them, apart from ScotRail. So yeah, great, fantastic. But for me, this is just the starting point. I think with the announcement, you know, the Scottish Government, there was like the photographs taken and, you know, yay, this is all exciting and great news. Yeah, it is. And it's been welcomed by all the right people, trade unions, for example. But this is just the starting point for me when it comes to tackling the climate crisis, making public transport accessible for everyone, safe for everyone, and really starting to shift the narrative away from, you know, the car ownership and using cars to get around is the most convenient and cost-effective way for people to get from A to B. But for us to get to that stage, there is so much integration that needs to be done, and we need to actually start providing good quality services across ScotRail, across, you know, when more things come into public ownership. So for me, yeah, it's great. Super excited. I'm really, really happy to see it. I'm glad to see the back of Abellio. But for me, I'm just watching to see what happens next.
I'm pretty happy with it too. You know, some things, as a socialist, maybe I shouldn't say this, but some things work okay in private hands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some things were too important to be left to the private sector, and public transport is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you privatise things like some buses are very profitable, some bus routes are profitable. The main route from an area into Glasgow will be profitable. You'll have plenty of companies desperate to get that. Not so many will be desperate to get the bus that only has a few people that takes it up to the back of some housing scheme somewhere. But it's really important for the people that happen to live up the back of that, mm-hmm. for the pensioner that lives up there. Like, it's literally like a lifeline to them. So mm-hmm. that just does not work in a private sector sort of environment because mm-hmm. it's not financially viable. So you need the public sector to run some of these things because they're not looking to make a profit about it. They're looking to run it as a service.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you're going to do that, they need to be running the routes that make money in order to balance out the routes that don't. The worst thing you can have is when you allow the private sector to cherry pick some mm-hmm. of the routes and then just leave the public sector with the ones that are draining the taxpayer.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm delighted to see ScotRail back in public hands. I just worry that this the company owned by the Scottish government, I hope it doesn't just start acting like a private company. It happens to have shareholders that are all government owned, you know. Mm-hmm. I hope it behaves like a public service as opposed to a private company that happens to be owned by the government. And I suppose time will tell with that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, train fares are way too high.
It's ridiculous. You know,
in fact, just transport fares in general are too high.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope one of the things that this leads to is cheaper fares for people.
Absolutely.
Cheaper fares, more reliable service, the whole shebang.
Mm-hmm. And just going, just chime in what you were saying about the, you know, the pensioners who might live, you know, at the back of a housing scheme. I mean, I'm from a housing scheme at the back of Falkirk originally. And the cost of bus travel over the years has just spiraled, completely spiraled in this particular council estate, which is where I'm from. There's a lot of deprivation and stuff in that area. And, you know, now buses are extremely expensive in these areas. And where they were built, you know, out of towns, like places like Cumbernauld and stuff is exactly the same, where you need public transport to get in and out of the town if you don't have a car because you're too far away to walk. The way it's been designed, you know, you don't have pavements and safe pathways to walk to certain places. They're designed for buses or for, you know, cars to take people where they need to go. And that just kind of further adds to the isolation and, you know, the access to people to use public sector services in town, all that kind of stuff. But also just going on to what you were saying about the cost of train fares. I mean, I lived up in Dundee until September last year, and I was doing my PhD through Strathclyde. And for me to get to Strathclyde on a peak service, okay, for one day, and this train takes, what, an hour and 20 minutes, an hour and a half, I was £43 return for one day.
Sorry, going to where?
From Dundee to Glasgow.
£43 on a bus?
Yeah.
Wow.
And for that, for £43, that's your return for your peak day, you could get a flight to London for that. You could get a return on a megabus for the night bus for that. So this is just how crazy it actually was. And it was because of that, the really high fares, I couldn't afford to take teaching on, which I should be doing as part of my career development, because it cost me more than my, you know, 4 or 5 hours what I was getting paid for my travel. That's how bad it is. And that in itself is actually quite a busy line. Like Dundee to Glasgow is quite a busy line. So you can just imagine what it would be like for some of the towns and the cities way further up north that are not quite as busy. So the Scottish government, is great that you've taken on, it's great that it's gone back into public service. But, you know, when they first took it over, there was that kind of like, you know, you can take somebody on the train for who's under 50 for free, and they're given little discounts and stuff like that. That's not good enough. These sort of gimmicks and, you know, come for, you know, use this service for this and that. And it needs to be permanent things, things that people can plan their lives around, their employment around, their study around. It needs to be cheap and accessible at all times. And it, you know, let's just forget about the gimmicks and start regulating and start making public transport more linked, so it actually helps people rather than, you know, drum up support on a Saturday Sunday so you can take your whole family through to Edinburgh or Glasgow for the day. It just, you know, it's not great.
Well, I just want to say, if you ever have any trouble with the bus service in Falkirk, just let me know, because my uncle Bobby's a bus inspector in Falkirk, so I'll just have a word and you'll get it sorted, right?
Well, if you can have a chat with him about the return fares for people that live in Hall Glen, then that's that would be good.
Should be all right, because he lives in Hall Glen as well.
Well, there you go. It should be cheaper than that.
I'll just get a pen and write that down, okay?
You just write that down.
Okay, we're moving on now. It is now the official start of the local election campaign that is due to election day is the 6th of May. I'm looking at you as a...
it's 5th.
That, Brian. 5th of May. The 5th of May. So... when it was announced, 18 councillors were immediately elected,
mm-hmm.
because there was not enough, or there was the number of candidates did not exceed the number of seats available in that ward. I definitely never heard of this before. I don't know, maybe it's happened before, but I certainly wasn't aware of it. Have you ever heard of that before, Brian?
No, I was, when I heard about that and how wide scale it was, I thought it was maybe going to be like one ward somewhere that, you know, that's happened in, but it was actually quite a few. And no, I haven't heard of it before, but it might have happened.
This might tie in. There has been rumours that a lot of parties, even bigger parties, are struggling to mm-hmm. find candidates. Certainly Labour must have been struggling when they thought it was a good idea to run a former Orange Lodge Grand Master in Airdrie North.
Yeah.
Certainly I'm running myself as a Green candidate in Blantyre. And locally we've had our issues trying to get people to run. I don't know if it's the same thing with all the parties. I think 2 years of COVID and people not meeting in person as much, I think has hampered a lot of branches and sort of building up a kind of wider network of people that they then can take aside and talk to. So it's left everything feeling very formal.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe there's no room for the informal conversations if somebody wants to know, you know, more about standing or what it involves. I know even SNP, who, you know, with their ludicrously big membership, there was a couple of places they didn't field candidates even, so there might be something to it.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree with your analysis, because obviously I'm a Green Party, a Scottish Green Party member, and I stood in 2017 in Rutherglen South, and I probably wouldn't have stood if it wasn't for these kind of informal conversations that we'd had after meetings and, you know, like, oh, you know, like, go for it. It's all about building, you know, representation and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, and it's the same with all meetings and in all different contexts. That it all becomes very formal. There's not much opportunity for those kind of informal discussions. So I definitely think that's got a part to play in it. The local elections seem to, like, start really late. Like the campaigns and things like that. Like, I mean, it was really just kind of been last week that the SNP sort of kicked off their manifesto. There was the Greens in Edinburgh had like a sort of launch. So it just kind of seems quite late. Normally it seems to be a bit more of a build-up, but it definitely seems to be quite late. Well,
the Greens' official launch is, as we're recording, tomorrow in Enniskillbride. So I'm going to be there.
That's exciting. Yeah. Are they doing it in Enniskillbride East?
I'm not sure.
They should.
I totally can't remember the venue. Mm-hmm. I think it might be the Arts Centre in Enniskillbride. I'm not sure what ward that's in.
That's super exciting. But no, it's good that it's good that the Greens are doing their launch somewhere different. Not necessarily in the city centre somewhere, like in Edinburgh or things like that. It's good that it's somewhere that's not necessarily where you would expect. To me, these kind of elections, they seem almost sad. Like, I don't know if it's just because I'm exhausted, because I've tried to work out how many times I've actually voted since the referendum in 2014, and it is really, really high, because we had a by-election when I lived in Rutherglen as well.
You ran in it.
I did, yes, thank you for pointing that out. But I think it's actually been 10 times, something as high as that, since 2014.
So, yeah, when you take in referendums, yeah, and things like that.
All that kind of stuff. I mean, that's in 3 general elections, 2 Holyrood elections, you know, local elections, all that kind of stuff.
No more European elections, right enough, so.
Well, there's that too, yeah, which is sad. Yeah, predictions for this local elections, it's so hard to call where it's going to go. I would not like to be a Scottish Tory standing in these elections because of all the different issues that the Tory party's had, you know, whether it be Partygate, whether it be, you know, Rishi Sunak, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, Boris Johnson just being Boris Johnson, and then like Douglas Ross calling for Boris Johnson to resign and then not calling him for him to resign, and then all the Scottish Tories MSPs wanting the Prime Minister to resign, and now they're all backing him in this election. I would not like to be a Scottish Tory candidate in this particular election. Other than that, I can't see a huge shift. I think the Tory vote is going to drop, which I think will benefit Labour. But I think it's maybe going to be the biggest winner of this election, I think, might just be apathy of people just not voting. I think that apathy will win the seats.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think, like, looking back at the last elections, you know, that was quite a good one for the Tories. So they're
very good for them, yeah.
They're at quite a high, which means there's a good chance their vote going to fall back naturally. So I think there's a good chance in Scotland, Labour will probably bounce back a wee bit because they had a terrible one last time. So
it's the red wave.
They'll probably go up a bit. The Tories will go down a bit. SNP will probably kind of hold on
about
to
the same,
what they've got,
I would say. Mm-hmm.
Which is a very high watermark. And I think probably the spin coming out of it is that Anas Sarwar's got Labour back in the road, even though, again, a bit like last year, he
lost the seat.
Mm-hmm. He basically only done well compared to the horrendous expectations that were built up. You know, by any other metric, it was a terrible result. But mm-hmm. I think the Lib Dems might bounce back a wee bit.
Do you know what? I actually don't think there's any Lib Dems standing in Falkirk. So there'll be no bounce back in Falkirk.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure where they're standing locally here.
Rutherglen South.
I grew up in Camaslang, and Camaslang and Rutherglen traditionally had quite a strong Lib Dem presence, which I thought was a Lanarkshire thing, but years later I remember looking at it and finding out that they had never had any seats anywhere else apart from Camaslang and Rutherglen. They used to pick up the odd seat. So I think Robert Brown is the only Lib Dem representative in South Lanarkshire Council.
He is.
I'm sure he'll hang on.
Maybe
they might squeeze another seat somewhere, I don't know.
Yeah, I think for Rutherglen it will be interesting to see what happens. I don't think there'll be a massive amount of change in South Lanarkshire Council. I'm hoping to see some Greens pop up. It'd be good to see East Kilbride East.
It'd be nice to see one pop up in Blantyre.
No, I'm joking. It would be really good to see Blantyre go green. If you're in the Blantyre Free State, David's going to work hard for you. He's a great candidate. You should vote for him.
And I'm already going down in history as the first ever Green to run in Blantyre. So,
is it the very first one?
The very first.
That's amazing.
So who knows? Maybe it'd be first shot, first goal, and I'll get elected. That would be pretty spectacular.
It would be really spectacular, but it's possible. So if you're in Blantyre, vote. And also, see that the polls that were done by Ballot Box Scotland, Ballot Box Scotland. So these, obviously, huge caveats because it was polls for local elections, obviously local wards, independent candidates and all that kind of stuff will have a huge impact. But there was a huge difference between Scottish Green being first choice and being second choice. So I think for first choice, it was around 4 or 5%, which is a lot lower than what we would originally expect, to be honest, from based on where the Scottish Greens are polling for Holyrood, which is anything between 9% and 12%. But for their second choice, the 24%.
Wow, that's pretty spectacular.
It's really spectacular. And I think that, you know, the message that will come out of this would be, if you want to vote Green, if you want a Green councillor, vote Green, because of the way the system works, that if they don't get through the first round, they've not got a chance. So, you know, that was something that I would definitely say on that one.
So you're saying if I'm going to get elected, it's going to be dramatically with a lot of second choice votes coming in, sweep me to victory?
I don't know how you could be anyone's second choice, David. I really don't understand that.
That's lovely to hear.
Good. I'm glad you like that. Yeah, I don't know what's necessarily going to happen with these local elections, but I think it's going to be more interesting to see what's happened in England and to see what happens there, because you've got, Boris Johnson's Tories and Keir Starmer's Labour, which is just not exciting. Keir Starmer's Labour, who today on Twitter has shared a Sun article about basically tougher sanctions for climate activists. So, I don't really know what direction, I think we know what direction the Labour Party's going in, but I just don't know where that's going to end.
Yeah, I think it'll be a bad result for Labour in England again, because
I think, we might see a lot of Greens and Lib Dems do quite well in England, I think.
As much as anything, I think Labour are just not going to inspire anybody to come out, which means the turnout, which is already abysmal, will be even worse, and that'll play into the hands of the Tories. It's the sort of that kind of reliable Tory vote that comes out hail or shine.
Yeah.
I think this maybe even will rally a bit because of how poor the Tory government's doing now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see how anybody could be inspired by Keir Starmer at the moment. So
not at all.
I think it'll be another bad result for them.
I think
which they'll somehow try to blame Jeremy Corbyn.
Of course, yeah, Jeremy Corbyn. It's his fault because how long has it been for? It's been, about 2 years, Keir Starmer's
two and a half years.
Something like that. Come on, stop blaming Jeremy Corbyn. I think it's going to be really good for the Green Party in England and Wales, potentially, in those local elections. And I think Lib Dems and other parties might do quite well. But I think the big story, which is completely absent from any news coverage whatsoever, is it's the Stormont elections in the north of Ireland on the 5th of May. I mean, that's just completely absent from any mainstream media, that unless you go looking for it. And I think that election will be extremely fascinating to watch. It's going to be a lot more interesting than what's going on in Scotland and England, where Sinn Féin have been polling ahead of the DUP for some time. So we could actually see the first minister of the north of Ireland being Sinn Féin, and the DUP coming in second. There's going to be huge growth in Alliance and the UUP as well, because the DUP's vote has dropped so much. So it will be quite interesting to see what happens in the Stormont, because that's happening on the same day.
Yeah, I'm trying to catch up on this because you mentioned this and it was totally off my radar.
You're too busy campaigning to get yourself elected in Blanton.
That's what it is. All about myself. All these elections are about me. But yeah, I mean, the Sinn Féin are quite considerably, like comfortably polling.
Is it 7 points or something like that, I think it is.
The most recent one was 7 points.
Yeah.
The last two actually were 7 points.
Yeah.
Which was up from 4 points before that, the start of the year. Yeah, it's quite, you know, it's a comfortable lead.
And, mm-hmm.
You know, and if you look at the combined unionist vote, mm-hmm. is barely hitting 40%.
Yep. And I think this is where Alliance is kind of cutting through to try and cut through this, you know, the typical boundaries in the north of Ireland, that they're kind of trying to cut through the middle and say, you know, we want to talk about, you know, the bread and butter issues, but actually they are affiliated with the Lib Dems. So
yeah, I mean, I think Alliance, you know, obviously they, you know, I'm kind of non-sectarian, but most of their vote, I think, traditionally does come from unionists, sort mm-hmm. of unionists that are uncomfortable with some of the kind of extremes of unionism, but maybe don't feel they can, you know, cross over to,
mm-hmm.
you know, a nationalist party.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting. I think out of all those elections that are happening all on the same day, that's the one that I'm most interested in watching the outcome for.
We'll certainly get the biggest potential in terms of, you know, and again, it'll come to a huge shock to most people mm-hmm. in the UK when they wake up, find that Sinn Féin has won this election.
Also,
and the first item now on the political agenda is a border poll for a United mm-hmm. Ireland.
I know, and they thought it was going to be NDRF2 was going to be the next one, but I think I think the border poll could be before that. Who knows? But I think what else is interesting is I don't know exactly when the next election will be, so it'll probably be in maybe about 3 or 4 years time, maybe 3 years time, for the Republic of Ireland, because Sinn Féin are also pulling ahead there. So they massively underestimated how well they were going to do in the last elections in the Republic of Ireland, and the last that I seen that they were doing extremely well. So they basically didn't field enough candidates to actually take up all the votes that they actually won. So they could actually have won more seats than what they would have done if they had fielded more candidates. So it'll be interesting to see when those elections come around what the makeup of Ireland would be, because it would be fascinating.
Yeah, I'm just catching up on the 2020 Irish election results. Sinn Féin were one seat away from being the largest party.
Yes, and if they'd fielded more candidates, they would have got that.
Yeah, the popular vote, they had more they had more votes than any other party.
Yes, so we could actually have the Republic of Ireland with Sinn Féin being the biggest party, and the North of Ireland, the Stormont, being Sinn Féin being the biggest party.
I'm quite excited about that.
I think it's really, really, it's just interesting, and what will come out of that, and what discussions will come out of that. It's obviously, there's a lot of complex layers and things that will contribute towards that. But Sinn Féin has actually positioned themselves, particularly in the Republic of Ireland, as being a really leftist party to take on, you know, some real radical change that they want to have on some of the bread and butter issues, housing and all these types of things. So I think it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next round of elections, which, if you're saying that's 2020, it'll probably be in about 3 or 4 years time. So watch this space.
Yeah, and just want to point out to listeners that neither me or Brian are experts in Irish politics.
No.
So if we've completely said anything completely nonsense, apologies, and set us straight on Twitter.
Yes.
Anyone, the baby's crying and I left the monitor on.
I'm going to pause. Did you just complain that your baby was crying on the monitor and you got up and just turned it off?
Yeah, his mum will get him. She's upstairs.
Well, that's good then.
A professional podcaster would have turned off the baby monitor that was in the same room that he was recording.
I love it. But yeah, we're not professionals in Irish politics.
Hey, be honest, we're not professionals in Scottish politics.
That's true.
But we can bluff it.
We can.
We can't bluff our knowledge in Irish politics to the same level.
But what we can say is that I'm excited about what potentially might come out of these elections that's going to happen in basically 4 weeks' time.
I say we schedule NDRF 2 and the border poll for the same day. Just go all in.
And the Tories won't know what to do because they'll be, it's a good idea.
They can't cancel question time and all rush to the same place.
True, very true. I mean, where are they going to have it? Are they going to have it in Belfast or are they going to have it in Edinburgh? Or
well, they send Boris to Belfast and Stalmer to Scotland.
Send Boris up here.
I think they know that's a bad idea.
Exactly.
At least some folk in Northern Ireland like Boris, but they're not the ones that will need convinced to vote against a border poll. So,
very, very true. Very, very true.
So, independent Scotland, United Ireland, and then we can start sending arms to Welsh freedom fighters or something.
No arms.
Arms and legs. So they can canvas and leaflet, that's what I meant.
Oh, like arms to postlet leaflets through doors.
I don't know what you thought you were, was talking about. Well, one more topic this evening. It's been all over a lot of the media for the last few days, and it's all about the tax issues of the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, and his fabulously wealthy wife. I've been struggling to keep up with it, if I'm perfectly honest. There is a lot of ins and outs and complicated details. So I'll hand it over to Brian, who's done a wee bit more digging than I have, give you an overview of the story.
Yeah, I'm going to give you an overview of this mess that's been happening basically over the last sort of 8 or 9 days. All this is kind of taken from various different news sources and Twitter. It's all been fact-checked, so you'll be fine. So, Rishi Sunak's wife, Akshata Murthy, has shares in her dad's company called Infosys. She receives £11.6 million in dividends last year. She is registered as a non-dom, which means that she does not have to pay tax on any income that she receives from any international income, basically. Despite having two homes here and until recently living on Downing Street, she has saved around £2 million in tax. So she doesn't have to pay any money on money that she received from outside of the UK. Rishi Sunak basically said that his wife's finances has nothing to do with his role as Chancellor, but his role as Chancellor basically sets the rules for tax, including for non-doms. Writing in The Scum last week, he was basically saying that people were trying to smear his wife to get to him, which is weird. Murthy basically came out then a couple of days later actually with a statement saying that she understands the British sense of fairness, and she found that some people might find her role as a non-dom as incompatible with the fact that Rishi Sunak is the Chancellor, but decided that she was going to keep her non-dom status regardless. But then after that, she then said that she would start paying tax on any income that she makes from abroad. Okay, this is just crazy. So basically, that would cost about £2 million to basically save Rishi Sunak's job, which is £150,000 a year. So it makes you think why you would want to do that. Because she's a non-dom, basically, any inheritance that her family would receive, she can choose to follow the rules in India, where she is, where Dosamal is basically stated, or in the UK. In the UK, she would have to pay it's estimated about £280 million on any income that she would have from inheritance, or in India, where it's 0%, because basically inheritance tax was abolished about 40 years ago. There's so much more that I need to go into with this, but I'm going to be really brief because this is just, the more I'm reading this out, I'm just like, this is just mental. Until autumn 2021, both Murthy and Sunak held green cards in the US, okay? And that means he had a US green card for 18 months after he became the Chancellor of the UK, okay? And basically during that time, he might have been paying tax to the US, and I say might be because he probably wasn't, but he was actually the second most powerful politician in the UK at this particular point. And Sunak's response to this was that he wants an investigation into who actually leaked his wife's tax arrangements. Out of all the things that's been said, that's what he wants to investigate. Diane Abbott had a fantastic tweet. She was like, Rishi Sunak still does not get it. The issue is not the leak. The problem is that he and his wife thought that they could get away with it with dodging UK tax in the first place. She is spot on. And basically, on Sunday evening, Sunak has written to the Prime Minister to refer himself to the ministerial declarations of the Independent Advisor of Ministers' Interests, basically saying that I haven't broken any rules and I need this independent body to tell me that, which if you need a body to tell you that, then there's something a bit sus there. And he is adamant that he has not broken any laws and he has followed all the rules.
It's easy to follow the rules when you're writing them, though, I would say.
Exactly. And it's easy to follow the rules when you've got all that money and all that time and all those people that can help you. Follow the rules, but act unethically.
I mean, it's the green card bit that I just really get my head around. I mean, the stuff about the tax, and you just kind of go, of course, because we know, you know, particularly Tories, but anybody with loads of money that in the UK, they don't have to, basically they don't follow, have to follow the same kind of rules as us in terms of tax, where we don't get a choice if we pay tax, whereas for them, they seem to think it's optional.
Mm-hmm.
It was the green card stuff. It was the fact that his wife was, for tax reasons, domiciled in India. Mm-hmm. He was, for tax reasons, sort of domiciled in the USA, apparently. Yet they were both living in fucking Downing Street. I mean, come on. They're literally living at the heart of the UK government. Yet for tax reasons, they were in different continents. Not just from the UK, different continents from each other. It's just ludicrous. And it's the kind of ludicrousness that normal people would laugh in your face if you tried to convince them that. But when it's all written in, you know, when it's all written down in paper and it's, you know, to do with tax reasons, apparently you can put forward the most stupid things and it'll be accepted because it falls within the ludicrous rules that they have written for themselves. It's just a joke, and the joke's in us.
And it's not funny, especially in the context of the living, the cost of living crisis that we're under, whether it be fuel bills, whether it be food, whether it be access to safe and secure housing, all these different things. And it's just not funny. I just think the most interesting thing, obviously, there's a lot of centrist politicians that have come out and saying how furious they are. These same politicians, people like Chris Bryant, have also had questionable decisions around their choices to buy, do up flats, sell them off, and all these different things, who have obviously used the system to benefit themselves. And they're just so outraged by this. And it must be corruption. Well, we know it's corruption. There's been corruption going on in this government all the way through a pandemic where, you know, more than 170,000 people have died, right? We know that the corruption has been going on. Well, the country was in such a complete disarray. But it's a conflict of interest when you've got somebody who is basically creating the tax rules and has the privilege to be able to locate yourself in different places around the world to benefit your own personal, you know, circumstances when it comes to your tax affairs. And it's almost got to, and we were even saying this in January, that things can't get more ludicrous in this government. But apparently they can. And Rishi Sunak, who was seen, particularly at the start of the pandemic, was like, you know, this, you know, dishy Rishi. And, you know, he was polling really, really high. And it was like,
Superman
is going to be the next prime minister. And now, you know, it's on the front page of The Express and The Daily Mail and The Observer saying, oh, you know, Rishi's chances of becoming prime minister have, you know, just been pissed up the wall because of all these different things. I just think that what this whole story has just exposed the Tories and their ideology and their view on the working class is complete disregard, and basically they don't care, because all they're more concerned about is making sure that they're, you know, following the rules, and so they don't get, you know, so there's not legal action, but they're basically doing things that's convenient for themselves so they can save as much money as they can and accumulate more wealth whilst people are struggling to pay their fuel bills.
Yeah, and there's a lot of speculation that the leak came from people close to Boris Johnson who wanted mm-hmm. to sort of cut Rishi Sunak knees out from under him because he did seem like he was starting to look like the Prime Minister in waiting.
Yes.
Which, you know, if his reputation doesn't survive this, which you wouldn't expect it to.
No.
It's a very short list of who is there now in the Tory ranks that is not absolutely...
Do you know who is actually on that list and is apparently not that unpopular?
Who?
Do you know? Liz Truss.
I was just about to say she is the favourite now, according to the bookies I just checked. The favourite Tory, Keir Starmer, is now the favourite to be the next Prime Minister.
But
considering he's a leader of one of the two parties, he's 61, which makes me think the bookies really don't have a clue either who's likely to be the next PM. Liz Truss is at 81, who is just a walking meme. I mean, for God's sake, she tweeted out concern about a war crime and included a picture of herself smiling.
Mm-hmm.
A big cheeser, like, publicity shot. And you're like, why would you think that was the appropriate picture to tweet out when you're talking about a potential mass murder?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, where to begin?
Yeah.
Rishi Sunak is hanging in at 9-1 at the moment behind her. I literally don't know who the next guy is.
What's his name?
Tom Tugendhat.
Don't know who that is.
It looks like a made-up name, but I presume he's real.
Well, if he's in
there. And then Jeremy Hunt. Jeremy Hunt? Is he still about?
He is. He's still an MP. But
you quite quickly get into the 33-1 shouts like Michael Gove.
Mm-hmm.
Ian Duncan Smith is a 33-1. Douglas Ross, 50-1.
Womp womp.
It's just a who's who of.
It's like a rogues gallery. It's absolute rogues gallery. But yeah, I think that when it comes to the Rishi Sunak story, like I really wanted to talk about it and just give that really short, brief run through, because it really has been done to death to some extent on the mainstream media. But I think it's important for people to see it in the context to them and they're, you know, being forced to pay more national insurance, for example, their fuel bills and the cost of food and all these different things. Because wouldn't it be great if we could just, you know, shimmy some things around and be like, oh, do you know what, I'm going to negotiate how much tax that I particularly pay on this part of my income and stuff like that. It's just a privilege that a lot of people just never ever have, and basically that nobody should, if the working class don't get to decide how much tax they would like to put forward to support public services and, you know, all these really obscure and strange rules that have been around since 1799, by the way. And, you know, also important to point out how many Labour governments have we had during that time that could have tightened up on all these rules that just chose not to. It's just, particularly in the context of how horrendous things are for working class people, it's just makes me really, really angry.
Yeah, I filled up my car when I get back from Blackpool today.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just one of the automated pumps.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've used them, but you put your card in and it says like £99. I thought I was going to break the pump because I thought, what happens when it goes over £99? It stopped at £98.30.
Mm-hmm.
And now I can't help but think that, are they going to have to reprogram these pumps?
Yeah.
Because otherwise it's not going to be long before people filling up their tank will exceed the theoretical sort of silly amount that they used to put on it because they wanted to make sure it was covered.
Yeah, and also similarly too, it's just the cost of energy, like, you know, like on your fuel bills in the home and things like that, that it's just some crazy amounts that people have been quoted, you know, an uplift in what they were before.
Yeah, mine have doubled.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a big family, so I've got a big house, and I've went from 200 a month to 350, which is significant.
That's really, really significant.
And I've seen online other people, it's shot up a lot more than that. So, I mean, there's going to be a lot of people that just cannot absorb that kind of cost.
And the fact that the Chancellor, who was absolutely ridiculed for that sort of pathetic spring statement that basically didn't address, you know, the urgency of the cost of living crisis. We've got, you know, so many other crises, but actually we've just become this giant crisis. You know, you've got the climate change crisis and, you know, because of the war and the invasion of Ukraine, that we've got, you know, they want to shift away from using Russian gas and Russian oil and all these different things, when actually it's only like 3-4% of what we use. You know, that seems to be the headline, that we need to move away from this. It's like, we need to come up with, you know, with a good energy strategy, price caps and support for people that urgently need it. Instead, we've got a Chancellor who's having to do a PR stunt because of basically playing the system so they don't have to give over some money to the taxpayer. They also gave him and his wife, so Sunak and his wife, gave a huge donation to Winchester College. as well, which is a private school. So instead of paying tax into the UK system, which would support state schools and all the other public services around the UK, they chose just to give a chunk of their money to a private school. So that there's the Tories for you.
Once again, we're finishing on an absolute downer.
I'm so sorry.
All I can say is don't vote Tory, because they're a shower of, you know what. Thanks for joining me, everybody. Thanks to Brian. Like I said before, hopefully Deborah will be back next week. Hopefully we'll get back to providing regular content and hear from you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.